Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum. I'm very glad to be here. It's my first time to visit Portland. I keep hearing that the summer is really nice, so this is so I shouldn't let the weather deter me from coming back. Inshallah, we'll see if we have that opportunity. I thought that tonight we didn't really pin down any specific topic, but I thought that something that might be good for us to just engage in discussion about are looking at the challenges and opportunities that are before us as Muslims living in America. There are many, and so I'm just going to focus a little bit on some of the ones that I think are of importance, and then afterwards we can talk about other issues, if you like, that I didn't address. And some of them related to some of the experiences that I've had over the years related to the U.S. government, the other activities that I've been involved in, and so forth, to just shed some light on that, and then we can hopefully have a good discussion. I think that when we look at the challenges or the obstacles that are before us, there are those that are external, imposed by the society that we live in, and the internal obstacles that we have imposed upon ourselves as a Muslim community. And so talking about external, of course, I don't have to tell everybody here, when you just look at just basic survival living in the United States, especially if people are, you know, immigrants and have questionable immigration status, that group has probably suffered the most after 9/11 in terms of uncertainty about their lives, separation from their families, deportations, people being disappeared right afterwards. And I think we have to sort of acknowledge really the devastating effect that had on certain elements of our community, sometimes that we didn't even know about, because it was happening in ways that were kept from us. But since that has happened, we're all dealing with sort of this overlying layer of suspicion that exists more or less in some places or others, depending on where you live, as to who we are as Muslims living in America. As you recall, in the aftermath of 9/11, there was a lot of effort to distinguish between, you know, groups who were engaged in violence and everybody else. But over time, it seemed like efforts to gain understanding, especially in the mainstream media, as well as within the government, particularly this administration, that those efforts diminished more and more. And so you had louder and louder voices that were articulating a more extreme vision and looking at, with complete negativity at Muslims, that as if we are really a fifth column and waiting to erupt at any time. I don't know if any of you have seen on television, but now starting, I think, this weekend on Showtime, they're going to have a series called Sleeper Cell, which is about a group of American Muslim terrorists that are plotting some horrible chemical weapon attack in the United States. But there, you know, whether this effort is deliberate on the part of certain groups, either politically or religious organizations and so forth, or whether it's just the media sort of capitalizing on a sensational story and getting the most out of it, the result is to do several things. And the main objective is to minimize the influence of Muslims in America and the American political arena by doing the following. Number one, minimizing our potential influence and downplaying our effectiveness. The Wall Street Journal had an interesting article talking about, you know, the role American Muslims are playing, and it was very positive in some ways, but they referred to our number as 2 million. You know, there's supposedly 500,000 Muslims in Los Angeles alone. How could, you know, one-fourth of the population of Muslims exist there? So there's a tendency to downplay even our demographic strength, to minimize people's attitude towards us, I would say, in the government, to look at, say, well, you don't really have to worry about Muslims as a constituency because there's only 2 million of them in the first place. The second is to demonize us, like in this movie and in other ways, to say, to get experts. This happens not only in the media, but it happens in Washington in ways that we don't often hear about, where they will have hearings and they'll bring experts like Steve Emerson. Does everybody know who Steve Emerson is? No, not everyone. I'll just explain in a minute. And Daniel Pipes, both of whom prior to 9/11 have really displayed their colors as racist anti-Muslim zealots. They are not respected as scholars in academic circles by anybody whom they claim to be affiliated with. They're promoted by right-wing conservatives. And they're used. There was a hearing that the Senate Banking Finance Committee had talking about terrorist financing, and a spokesperson from the Treasury Department had invited Stephen Emerson to testify alongside him about Muslim charities and terrorist financing. And so we can't underestimate the impact that these kinds of individuals and groups have, the ones that promote them, on trying to undermine, again, our influence, exclude us from the political process that belongs to us as American citizens, but also to continue to demonize us and to tell one version of the story and to make allegations that don't have to ever be proven. There was another hearing recently by the Senate Justice Committee about the spread of Wahhabism in the United States. The Muslim Public Affairs Council, which I'll talk about a little bit at the end, I was able to have them postpone that and that hearing because the feeling was, what in the world is the Justice Committee doing talking about something that really should be the business of the International Relations Committee and so forth? And they ended up rescheduling it, and it was a little bit better because they had the person they had coming to represent the Muslim interest wasn't somebody that represented Muslims at all. And what this hearing was about a Freedom House study. Freedom House is an organization that looks at religious freedom around the world, pretty much mostly from the Christian perspective and from the very right-wing Christian perspective, had published a report last year on the existence of Wahhabi literature in mosques in the United States. So they had people going around to Islamic centers and masjids all around the United States and looking in their bookstores and writing down what literature they had and deciding X, Y, or Z was Wahhabi literature. And so then they reported this saying, you see, the spread of Wahhabism is in the United States. Because what they've done is instead of talking about Islam as being bad, then they've shifted to Islamism, then they've shifted to Wahhabism, and now the new term is Islamofascism, if you haven't heard it already. Actually, President Bush used it in a speech that he gave. But there was a hearing here, and again, they're not inviting people from the community to come and testify about what's going on in our community, what are people reading, how do we select literature. They already have the cards stacked against us because it's people who are setting the agenda will invite the people who tell them what they want to hear. The Saudi government did have some influence by having somebody who had experience in foreign relations with them to sort of debunk some of what was being said, and it was covered on C-SPAN. And then they also had the head of one of the masjids that they had targeted to be able to say, this really is not reflective of our community, and it's really not appropriate to be targeting us in that way. So they did modify it somewhat because of pressure, which is what we'll come back to, why we have to be strengthening ourselves in that regard. The third way is to co-opt us. Again, the idea being to minimize the influence or to take control over it. And what has been an interesting phenomenon is the creation and promotion of the good Muslim, right? The reformist Muslim, who is the one we want to promote as the identity of the right kind of Muslim living in America. This has particularly happened in Los Angeles with the LA Times and certain individuals that they would highlight and promote as if they're the most forward-thinking Muslim that ever was. Nobody else ever had any of the ideas that they did. And that really they're the ones who get, you know, who are on television, who are interviewed and so forth, whose books get published, who get invited to speak. But what qualifies them as good Muslims is that, number one, they engage in a lot of self-bashing, right? So that we've had this experience of trying to submit op-ed pieces to the LA Times, that if you didn't have enough language in there that said, yes, we're bad, we're horrible, we've done so many terrible things, and then you get to say your piece or what your point is about don't marginalize Muslims in America. If you don't have enough of that sort of self-flagellating language, they're not going to publish what you say. Also, if you're in general agreement with U.S. policy, particularly as it relates to the Middle East, the Iraq War, and the situation in Israel-Palestine. And so some of the examples of that are Irshad Manji. Has anyone heard of Irshad? She's a Canadian Muslim of South Asian background who has written a book called The Trouble with Islam. Now, she changed the title to The Trouble with Islam today because people asked her the question, if Islam is such a problem, why are you even still a Muslim? And she said, well, I'm waiting for things to get better and then I'll decide. But she has come out and challenges different groups as not doing enough, as Muslims being the source of problems and the Quran needs to be revised and certain pieces of it, you know, deleted and so forth. And so she's basically saying what certain elements want to hear. And then she gets propped up as being the voice of moderate, good Islam, even though she doesn't represent anybody within the Muslim community. In her book, at one point, she writes about how she stood on the shores of a settlement in Gaza, and at that point, she could really understand the whole purpose and focus of Israel's existence. I mean, so she really declared her allegiance at that point, and is a frequent guest at dinners with Anti-Defamation League, which is how I first heard of her, from one of my patients who was at an ADL dinner and said, oh, I heard this woman speak, she's wonderful, you've got to see her. But again, here's the idea that certain individuals get propped up as being the, you know, the good and proper Muslim. And in this way, it sort of takes the voice away from the authentic community that's been here for a long time and working on so many issues, whether it's women's rights, minority rights, just establishing our identity, as if we don't exist. And it's sort of that notion of, you know, looking at us as if we aren't here that has plagued us for a long, long time. Now, my experience is that, at least during the Clinton administration, and maybe this wouldn't have happened had 9/11 happened back then, but there seemed to be a lot more opportunities and an outreach within the towards the Muslim community. I was I was on the U.S. delegation to the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing in 1995, and I remember being at one session and someone I met. What would happen is, this was my first sort of introduction to some of the strange politics of Washington, is that you had the delegation that was there, but then you also had people from the right who were there to monitor the delegation and make sure they didn't get too out of control on certain women's issues, right? Whether it had to do with especially sexual reproductive rights. And I met one of these women who was, you know, from the right wing, and she was like, why are you even involved? You know, you share more of the conservative values as we do. And I said, well, you know, it just so happens they're the ones who invited us. I wouldn't be on this because I'm a Democrat or Republican. It's just because this is an opportunity. And she said, oh, well, I'm sure that when the Republicans are in power, they'll invite you just as much. And the truth is that that has not happened by any means. And it's not, I'm not making a partisan statement, because I personally have lost faith in all parties in Washington. But we did have some opportunities back then. Being with that delegation meant meeting people in the State Department, meant building bridges, and a lot of people were much more open-minded and inclusive at that time. And then that opened the door for being a part of this advisory committee on religious freedom abroad, and then the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, which was the baptism by fire. You'll forgive that metaphor, but you know, since we're Muslims, obviously, but because that was a real introduction to the fight that we're up against in Washington. But the Clintons did have Ramadan iftars. They've started that tradition within the White House, State Department, the Pentagon, and all different branches of government. They have not really been well sustained. They've now turned into basically invitations to embassy staff. Right, so the Muslims, instead of being American Muslims who come to celebrate Ramadan, which is, you know, a holiday we are celebrating here, they invite the staff from the embassies of all the Muslim countries, or the ambassadors. And so that way they get away from validating any of us or having to choose among us to say who the good Muslims and bad Muslims are, because in the end they're really, according to their definition, which is a good Muslim is the one who supports the policy, they can't really find anybody. And in general, this administration has been much less open. And so, for example, if there's an event, this came up recently, where someone had suggested me to come and speak on women's issues, and they said, no, no, she's a Democrat, or she's affiliated with the Democratic Party, which again, you know, is only because it was a timing issue. So that who's going to turn down an opportunity to represent our community, whether they're Democrat or Republican, but then all of a sudden you get punished for it later because they put that label on you, when that's really not a label that I put on myself. And so that kind of partisanship and politicization is very real and very problematic for us. Being on the Commission on Religious Freedom, you know, I had not been a conspiracy theorist up until that time, but it was being around people like the person who was responsible later for doing this report from Freedom House that I told you about, Nina Shea. I served on that commission with John Bolton. Has everybody heard of John Bolton? He's worse than what they said in the paper. And Elliot Abrams, who was, I think, indicted, or if not convicted, for lying during the Iran-Contra affair. It's a very strong Zionist who now works for the National Security Council under Condoleezza Rice and is the number one person after her in the Middle East, Israel-Palestine. But I remember getting started on this commission thinking, again, it's great, interfaith, people from different groups, Baha'is, Jews, Buddhists, Muslims, Christians, But the problem was, this was born out of the International Religious Freedom Act, which talked about, which was basically a way to expose how the Clinton administration wasn't doing enough to help Christians around the world. And it started out as an issue that was going to look at the persecution of Christians, Jews, Buddhists, and Baha'is. And it wasn't until other voices said, you know, if you're going to talk about religious freedom, shouldn't you talk about all groups? So I was one of the people appointed by the president to this commission. Others were appointed by different branches of government, depending if they were Republican or Democrat. It was supposed to be bipartisan, non-political, but wow, it really was something else, because some elements really looked at it as an opportunity to expose the weaknesses of the Clinton administration. This was when the issue of Sudan was very important, right, when the whole idea of Christian persecution in southern Sudan was a big issue. Saudi Arabia came up as an issue, again, about Wahhabism and about the persecution of Christians, and women who work there from the Philippines aren't allowed, there's no churches, and so on and so on and so. And it was an odyssey and a nightmare that lasted for 2 years. And time after time, after being exposed to the anti-Muslim sentiment that was just so in your face you can't even believe it, I would say, what am I doing here? Am I really accomplishing anything? I mean, and I would pray about it because it was really difficult, and I'll just share a couple of the stories to tell you why. And I felt my goal was really quite simple. It was to bring to light the issues that would otherwise be ignored. Like to talk about the fact that in Egypt, so that was a high priority issue because of the strong Coptic community in this country, that Muslims experience persecution under the Egyptian government if they disagree with Egyptian policy. That whether or not I may have agreements or disagreements about Ikhwan or other groups, that people who get labeled an Islamist or, you know, have the label of terrorist put on them and are subjected to detention, military detention that can last 6 months or longer and are tortured in prison. What about their religious freedom? And so it was to highlight the fact that Muslims living in Muslim countries are persecuted because of their faith. And that was a big issue for me because, number one, it showed that I was not afraid to criticize Muslim governments or to simply give them a rubber stamp saying, well, they're Muslims, I'm going to give them a free pass, because I don't think that's right for us as Muslims. The Quran tells us to be just and stand for justice, bear witness to the truth, even if it's against your own selves. And then secondly, it was to show people that it's not so simplistic, and you can't go around sort of claiming you're a champion for religious freedom and neglect the majority population who are affected by these policies. We were, you know, brought to light the plight of Muslims living in China. Again, the persecuted church in China was a big issue about these underground churches. But the problems faced by Muslims are quite unbelievable. They're not allowed to fast in Ramadan. They are involved, that what they're doing now is forced migration, or they're actually just demographic distribution. So they're having Han Chinese who are non-Muslim all migrate to the western provinces of China to dilute the Muslim population. Of course, everywhere in the world now, you can just say somebody is a terrorist, Islamist, and whatever, and nobody's going to question the kinds of crackdowns and human rights violations. But so that was my role, to sort of bring these things to light, to give people that voice. And to sort of be a thorn in their side, as it were. They, of course, kept talking about how horrible Sharia was for non-Muslims and so on and so forth, and I suggested, look, you know, you talk about this term as if everybody knows what it means. Muslims themselves don't really understand the full scope of what Sharia is. So why don't we have, just among ourselves, the 10 commissioners and the staff, a presentation or discussion about some of these basic concepts of Islamic law and some of the nuances and where any flexibility is. And they kept telling me, no, we don't need to do that. We don't want to do that, of course, because it was coming from me. So one day, and this was in the winter when it was raining and cold and snowing, and I was 9-10 months pregnant at the time. I was going to pass on the meeting because they were having them every month, and it was kind of hard for me to fly out to Washington, fly back, and miss work and all kinds of things. And sometimes I would be on the phone, which was very frustrating. And so I happened to call the director and say, so what's on the agenda for this meeting? Oh, Bernard Lewis is coming to talk about Islam. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I said, you know, because I had been suggesting that for a long time, and Elliot Abrams had invited him, a good friend of his. I said, I have a huge problem with that. You know, that's like me inviting one of my Muslim colleagues and scholars to talk about Judaism. Who would even accept that? When you have prominent, qualified members of that faith to be able not only either to speak to the issue or to bring somebody who can. And so it was interesting because I forced Elliot to talk to me about this because he sort of was being a little bit evasive, and he said he didn't think he needed to get my permission since he was the chair of the commission at the time. I said, well, it's a matter of courtesy. You have Cardinal, who was an archbishop at the time, Theodore McCarrick, on the commission. I would kind of assume that out of respect you would run it by him if you were going to bring an expert, a non-Catholic expert, to talk about the issues of religious freedom and Catholicism. Or Firuz Kazemzadeh, the Baha'i member, I know that you would talk to them. And so I ended up insisting on bringing an alternative speaker. So John Esposito was gracious enough to agree to come. It was very short notice. It was less than a week. And Elliot refused to have them be on the same panel because he didn't want, Bernard Lewis to lower himself to being in a debate because he's such a prominent scholar. And so that's what ended up happening. I had to fly out so that I could have a presence and say, this is really not acceptable to do these kinds of things. So they're on a very small scale, and nobody outside had any idea this was going on. But it seemed very important to me at the time because this is the kinds of ways that they attempt to take advantage of us, exploit our weaknesses, right? Here I am pregnant, living on the other side of the country, and, you know, if I'm not able to be there, wouldn't that be perfect? You'll have this one Muslim from the commission not be able to be there and challenge the non-Muslim expert when they're talking about Islam and religious freedom. And he ended up talking about something that happened, I don't know, back in the 16th century, and rabbits were involved in his story and rabbit meat, and I was complaining, like, he was really, it was just horrible. And of course Esposito was fantastic, and people could really see the difference. But that was just one example of many where at one point they had invited John Garang from the Sudan, who recently was killed in a helicopter accident, who was the head of this SPLA, this Sudanese People's Liberation Army, the main force fighting against the North and the government for their freedom. And so he came and was speaking. Again, I couldn't be at that meeting, but I'm sure I wanted to be on the phone. And so I had a question, and what happened was he was speaking, and one of the most interesting things he said was, we have to do something about the appeal of Islam to the young people. And I wanted to ask the question, you know, I mean, you've painted a picture of this brutal Islamic regime. How could anybody be attracted to Islam if that's sort of the image and message that's being transferred to them from within the government and from these, you know, militias that are coming down and killing them? And, of course, as soon as I started to ask the question, John Bolton said, that's all the time we have for questions, and that was it, and he completely cut me off. And it was so that there couldn't be any debate. And so it was that kind of sort of control. I tend not to be a person who likes conflict, so instead I developed an ulcer. I had an eye twitch. You know, thank God, alhamdulillah, my daughter was born healthy. But because I really, that kind of sort of bad faith undermining people really is so against the way I believe and the way I do things. A few months later, in May of 2000, my dad, Ali Arhamu, passed away very suddenly. And so here I was, having had a new baby, my dad had passed away, and still these kinds of things were going on, whereas, you know, kick them when they're down. So I have my own experience, but with influential people in Washington, just to let you know that that kind of attitude is very real, especially about preventing us from having access. They wanted to go on a trip to the Middle East. They wanted to go to Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and so I insisted that we go to Israel. Because I said, if you're talking about religious freedom in Egypt, you can't do that without talking about religious freedom issues in Israel, even among Jews themselves. And so I prevailed, and we did go. And at the end of these trips, you would produce some kind of a written document saying what were the findings were. So we went. This was in March. Our term would expire on May 15th. We were continuing to have debates and discussion, couldn't come to any agreement, right? Because to some people in the commission, Israel is not guilty of any human rights violations of any kind whatsoever, ever, ever, never. And so they're, you know, they couldn't come up with an acceptance. And what I figured was happening was that they were running down the clock so that May 15th would come and we, as the commission as it was, could no longer issue a statement because our term was over. So in anticipation of that, I prepared my own so that it was my statement as a dissent from their decision not to issue something was a good discussion of the serious religious freedom issues without being overly critical or being, you know, hyperbolic or anything. And it was part of the public record, which is still on the commission's website, because it went out on May 14th. And those kinds of sort of subtle, insidious ways, not telling you that a hearing is going to happen, letting you know 2 days before, can you come and testify? No, my life isn't organized that way. Well, we did ask somebody, but they couldn't come. So you see these kinds of little games that people play, which is why I could never live in Washington, and I tell my husband, don't even think about going there. I had hoped that being on the commission would be a way to open doors for future generations, but that doesn't seem to have happened. Since then, the other Muslim that they appointed after I left was Khalil Abu Fadl, who's a professor at UCLA, who doesn't go to any of the meetings because he's ill and he's busy with his profession. So they really don't have a Muslim voice on the commission, and it doesn't really have served much of a purpose anyway, because its full purpose was to bash President Clinton back in those days. I think in terms of these external challenges and being involved in government, we don't have enough of a presence at all in Washington. So when these things come up, you don't have Muslim lobbyists. The organizations that we think are there are not there on Capitol Hill, banging down the doors of these senators and congressmen saying you can't have this kind of thing without having a Muslim voice. You do have individuals working in different offices and in different departments, in justice or treasury and so forth, but there's really no organized effort. That's a huge weakness that we have to overcome. And that's something that we can talk about perhaps as ways to get past that, because we just do not have an effective grassroots nationwide lobbying organization that advocates on issues important to Muslim Americans. Not certain Muslim countries. Those guys are doing pretty well, I would say. But the interests of those of us living here and who call this our home. So those are just some of the external challenges I look at. Of course, the media is a whole other issue we could go into. But again, right now I see the media and the government as really getting much more closely aligned as the media becomes a mouthpiece for a lot of voices in Washington. The internal challenges, again, we have a lot, and I won't go into all of them. But I think in terms of talking about this same theme about our influence and lack thereof, is that it's still very difficult to persuade the Muslim community that it's worth putting their money into develop these kinds of organizations. There is a sense that it doesn't qualify as zakat. You know, these people don't really, it's not helping the poor, it's not Beit al-Mal, it's not really the needy, even though one of the criteria listed in the Quran is, it says to those, you know, part of it pays for winning the hearts over of the enemies of Islam, which this is really part of that, and also helps to build our infrastructure. So if we have strong political organizations, when a Muslim school or a masjid is getting attacked by somebody, you can have your groups come in and say, this is not acceptable, this is why. You have civil rights groups, so we all are there to support each other. But we haven't been able to cross that barrier of convincing the community that this is worth spending a lot of money on, and it's not cheap. There's distrust. There's decisions about wanting to manipulate the agenda and say, you should focus on this. Well, if you focus on Palestine more, then we'll help you. If you focus on this Kashmir more, then we'll help you. And there's sort of this sense that we're still not really aware of who we are as a people living in the United States. There's also the perception that, well, as long as we can continue to rely on money from the Gulf, what do we need to give the money for? And I'm sure you know as a community here, the extreme importance of developing financial independence and not having those kinds of financial ties overseas for your own sense of accomplishment, but also to eliminate accusations that we're just sitting here as representatives of somebody from some other country. Not only that, there may be strings attached to any money that comes from overseas. And then there's the perception that, well, we have one organization doing X, Y, and Z. Why do we need more? Right? So that, okay, if you have Islamic Relief doing all the charity work for everybody, then we don't need any other charities. Or if you have CARE or whatever organization, there's this sense that, okay, I support this, and I support this work, but it's almost in a sort of a unilateral sort of way, as opposed to saying we need to expand laterally to have much more of an influence, and the idea that one organization can do it all is simply not correct. Number one, it can't do it all. And number two, if it tries to do it all, it will do it all poorly just because it's overstretching its bounds. And thirdly, those organizations themselves need to understand that, because they tend to sort of reinforce that idea. If you look at other communities, they don't have just one human rights organization or one organization on political advocacy. If you look at the American Jewish Congress, American Jewish Committee, AIPAC, all kinds of groups, and they sort of talk among themselves to agree on what to focus on, so they're not all reinventing the wheel. We have not done that, and that's really a big problem.